KK4JBQ. Well, I just learned something, and I don't know how I might apply it the rest of my life, but I don't know what's coming. None of us do. Tomorrow, maybe a new opportunity, it may be a crippling event. I really don't know. When you get toward the latter third, I'll put it that way, of your life, I mean, you know what life expectancy is for your own people, and you know your health history, maybe, you know, you got a clue, anyway. But I've been given a piece of wisdom. How am I going to use that? I have noticed earlier in my life that these things come in dribbles. And it's the way they come to you. I mean, you can read, you know, a whole volume of wisdom. But until you can apply it, it really isn't yours. Until you see a use for it, you're not practiced with it, you know? And so it's a little bit scary, but I think maybe I'm inclined anyway to believe that I will use what you just gave me at some point. And I'll thank you for that. KK4JBQ.
You thank Barney. He's the one that taught me. I mean, he was just a master with people. And I mean, he had to be. Most platoon sergeants are, because they're just so. The people in the platoons are just so diverse. And when I first joined, women were not allowed in the military. Well, were not allowed in combat service roles. They were nurses and, you know, did in administrative units, but they would not allow women in a unit that served in a combat service role. But as the years went on and I got into, let's see, the 15th year, 13th year, somewhere around there, I had a situation in artillery. I started off in self-propelled howitzers. And one of the gun crews ran a howitzer off into a mud hole in January with ice on it, and it was just, I learned real quick that, you know, being the maintenance guy, you retrieval is part of your job as well, and I think I may have told you this story, but I learned real quick that, you know, the commander, he didn't have any concern about, you know, how cold I was or what my issue was as far as getting the howitzer out of the ice water. And that's when I realized, hey, you know, I need to, there's got to be an easier way to earn a dollar. So I went back and retook my ASVAB and scored really high on it as far as the electrical portion of it goes. So they had an opening in a communication unit. And when I transferred into that unit, there were females there. And, I mean, I didn't struggle with that. That was not an issue for me. It was just, you know, they were just a soldier in uniform. But as I moved up in rank and deployed on the last deployment in a senior leadership role, that was kind of a big deal. And I had to really change the way I carried and handled myself and how I dealt with with them, and I don't mean any offense here. That's not what I'm trying to say. It's just that they're just, I had to change as a person and a leader to be able to try to make that crust contact with a different kind of soldier. And one particular story comes to mind, and let me identify KO4NUE and KK4JBQ. When we got to our location in Iraq, I had 12 females that were in the unit with us. Some of them were radio, you know, they ran radios, and one of them was a TACSAT operator, and two of them were troposcatter, and the rest were kind of admin, or I think one or two of them were wire and cable section. And wire and cable section was the most physically active because they were out running transmission lines, burying transmission lines, terminating fiber, repairing twin ax, which is a special kind of coax that has two pieces of coax in it that hocked into the side of the shelters, that kind of stuff. So, and that was, we had a female in there, and it was just causing some issues. I'll just leave it at that. But the platoon was arguing because there was a little bit of drama every day. And I just finally just made up my mind and said, I'm tired of listening to this. I'm sick of it. So I just went out in the wire and cable section and said, hey, you're coming with me, and you're going to be my assistant. And we're going to end the drama. So I needed an assistant with me in the office. I had so much paperwork, I didn't know whether it's coming or going. But I moved her in the office with me, and she helped me administratively through the rest of the deployment. But one particular instance was that the ziggurat was located right outside of where our FOB was. Have I told you this story, Larry? I can't remember.
It might bear repeating because you're telling it from another beginning point. I will be able to relate in any event. KK4JBQ.
Talking about a pocketbook. Is this? Have I told you this already?
Doesn't sound that familiar? No.
Okay, so there was a local guy from Nasiriyah who was an Iraqi, and he was the not curator, but he watched over the ziggurat. He was just an older guy in the town who just watched over it and made sure that nobody was doing anything to it that would, you know, deface it or anything. But and you can Google the ziggurat and what it looks like. Well, that was right outside of our perimeter. I think the actual translation is House of Terror. But anyway, a bunch of the soldiers, you could hire him for the day to give a tour of the ziggurat and tell you all about it. And one of Daniel's, and Biblical Daniel, his supposedly his village or whatever was right outside where the ziggurat was. There was leftover pieces of the foundation that you could tour with the ziggurat tour. Well, a bunch of soldiers wanted to go on a tour with the ziggurat, and I would not let them. You're not going outside of the perimeter. You're not going to do it, and quit asking me, because it just became such a hassle that I just told the whole unit, you're not leaving the FOB, the safety of the FOB, I'm responsible for you, and you're not doing it. Well, this specialist Hill, which was now my assistant, she was a younger girl. She was in her 20s, and any soldiers that left the FOB, you had to leave it a certain way. And if they wanted to, if I needed to fly them to another location in Iraq, there was a set of orders cut and a request from the Air Force to fly that soldier. Because you can't just let them leave. You have to track them where they go to make sure that they got there and that they're still alive. So one day, she came in with this little square mirror. It was about 3 inches by 5 inches that she had got at the PX. And she glued it to the wall in front of her, and her back was always to me. And she put on her makeup in that little mirror every morning, and I thought it was for her makeup. But she had put that on the wall because the next day I got a set of orders that came across my desk with a request to fly to Basra with her name on it and another female who was in the mail room. So she had put that mirror there so she could see my reaction when I got the orders. And I read the orders, and I looked up, and I saw her glancing in that mirror, and it dawned on me what she was doing. And I said, "Hill, what's up with these orders?" And she says, "Well, me and Putman want to go to Basra." And I said, "Absolutely not. You know better than to even ask me. You're not. I've already told you you're not leaving the FOB." About 20 minutes later, she gets up and goes to the mail room. So here comes her and Putman, both females, and come in the office and said, "We won't talk with you. You can't be rigid about this. We need to go to Basra." And I said, "Absolutely not. You're not going to Basra." And I started raising my voice. Well, the commander came over. And he said, "What's going on over here? What are you so upset for?" And I said, "They're giving me a hard time, and they're wanting to go to Basra, and they're not going to leave the FOB. Absolutely not. No questions asked." So that settled things for about 15 minutes. They left, and then here they come with Sergeant Blanding, and she was an E6. She was an administrative female. So now I've got three of them in the office, and they are on my butt wanting to go to Basra. So finally I just said, "What is the big deal? Why do you need to go to Basra?" And Hill says, "Well, in Basra, right outside of the FOB, they have got markets there, and they make knockoff Gucci pocketbooks. And we want to go to Basra and get a pocketbook." And I was just flabbergasted. And I just thought, you want to fly 400 miles to one of the most dangerous FOBs we have to get a knockoff Gucci pocketbook? Looked at me and said, "Yes. Yes, we do." And I said, "Okay, I'm not arguing with you anymore. I'll schedule the DMR flight, and y'all can go down to the PAX terminal and get a flight. But you're gonna fly on what I tell you to fly on, and you know, 'cause some flights were better than others, and some of them were safer than others, and I knew which helos to fly on that I thought was safe. So I took them down to the PAX terminal, put them on the helo I wanted them to go on, and off to Basra they went. And I said, you've got 4 days. You be back here in 4 days. No questions asked. Day 5, they're not there. So I'm panicking and get on the phone with the NCYC down in Basra and said, hey, where is Putman and Hill? And well, you know, we've had a little bit of a problem, and they're okay, but they're shook up a little bit. And I thought, oh Lord, I cannot believe this is happening. What is going on? So he explained to me what had happened, but I said, okay, well, you get them on the nearest flight and get them back to Tallil and have them report to my office ASAP. Into the office, and she's in tears. Putman was a little bit more resolved, but she was absolutely in tears. And sat down in the desk, sat down at her desk in front of me with Putman, and I could tell she was upset. And I said, Putman, you're dismissed. And I said, Hill, what's going on? And she held up her pocketbook, and there was a hole in it, a big hole. So out of all of this, they get all the way to Basra and get ready to come back on day four. Get ready to board the Hilo, and the helicopters flying pairs for safety. And they're getting ready to board the second Black Hawk, and three mortar rounds came in, and evidently they were trying to hit the helos, I guess. And a piece of mortar fragment went through her baggage, which was, I don't know, 25 yards away from her. But the point is, the mortar fragment went through her baggage and put a hole in the pocketbook. So, out of all of this mess, she comes back and she's not upset that, you know, she could have got hurt. She was upset because there was a hole in the pocketbook that she worked so hard to go and get in Basra. And I just thought, that's when I realized right then that, okay, this requires some different soldiering here. This requires different leadership, because if you're willing to go that far to get a pocketbook, oh man, I could not believe it. I just could not believe it. But it was quite the experience. It took some different leadership, is what I'm trying to say, to manage that. Not more difficult or bad, just different.
Wow, what a story. KK4JBQ. We are different. We are made to be different. Donna is left-handed. And that's different. I'm right-handed. But now I have lived with her for going on 30 years. And I can tell you a certainty that I have come to understand. This difference has to be acknowledged. And by both of us, you know. I've understood now that a left-hander sees the world differently than I do. It's inverted in some way. It isn't upside down. It's inverted left to right. We were watching some recorded television. We have a TiVo, and that it's priceless to us, because we don't have a lot of time for television. We don't have a lot of time for the commercials, you know. So a TiVo will allow you to fast forward anything, because it records everything that you ask it to record. And it does so with an interface that is so excellent. I've tried other digital video recorders. TiVo is tops. But we were watching this recorded art presentation, and both of us are artists in our own way. So the artist explains that when he was constructing the elements of his painting, that he wouldn't put something right in the center. And because he was right-handed, he put it off to the right side. And he explained that if you're left-handed, you might feel more comfortable to put this, another vertical element, off to the left side. And it struck me right then, and I paused the show, and I had this little discussion with her. And she said, oh, yeah, yeah. If it looks great, if I imagine it over on the left-hand side, but it looks wrong the way he's doing. He's a right-hander, and it looks wrong to me. Have I explained that well enough to... It is a physiological thing. Do you understand? KK4JBQ.
KO4NUE, absolutely. Absolutely, you're exactly right. My wife absolutely amazes me how her mind works sometimes, and I think there is no way in the world, that she is right or this is going to work. No way. But I don't know, Larry. I don't know how to explain it. But man, sometimes, most of the time, she is dead on. So I have learned to understand what is her lane or what she is, what her forte is, and she understands what my forte is. And there are times when I realize, hey, this is where I need to be. This is where I need to be quiet and just let her do this and let her handle this, because it's gonna turn out perfect. And then she does the same for me. So I get it. I do. And I think I didn't always get it. And initially in our marriage, that was a hard lesson to learn. And it caused some problems initially in the marriage, because I'm thinking, no, I'm the man of the house. This is the way it's going to be. But boy, that's really not smart. And it took me about 4 or 5 years to learn that it's a team here, and it's a team for a reason. And she's just absolutely excellent. I mean, now, don't get me wrong, I mean, she's not going to go down to the shop and do what I do, but that doesn't mean that's a bad thing. It's lateral. It's left and right. It's not up and down, if you understand what I mean.
I do understand what you mean, KK4JBQ. I think it's every husband's destination to come to terms with the fact that you are two people, two different people, different upbringing by different parents in different socioeconomic situations. And you forced a coming together. And it is just that. In metallurgy, it's called an amalgamation. It's also called that in geology also. That was one of my favorite subjects in college, geology. If you have rock that is subducted into the ground to the point that it nears the mantle and it gets reheated, becomes not liquid but plasticized, it will undergo a metamorphosis, and the other rock that surrounds it becomes a part of it. It amalgamates, and then it's returned to the surface. The pressures in the earth return it to the surface, and then it's something really special. Oh, like an opal. It's special. That's exactly how opals are formed. It becomes something as solid as granite. That's metamorphosed rock. I love geology. Anyway, you become blended, and it takes a while to do that. It takes certain forces to do that also. So, and some people don't encounter those forces. They want to stay away from conflict. Conflict will strengthen you if you should survive it. So, rather than run from it, just welcome it when it comes. Do your very best to live through it. Some folks don't, and they have to part ways. You know, I understand this. It took me a long time to understand these things. KK4JBQ.
So we have, actually, we've learned to have visual cues when we're, you know, in a conversation together or a situation, especially a verbal conversation, most of the time with our children. she will wink at me with her right eye. And I mean, it's quick. You have to be watching to see it. But that respectfully means, hey, be quiet and let me do this. And on the reverse of that is that when I've reached my limit, you know, I'll reach up and with my thumb and scratch my left nostril, and that means, okay, you be quiet. It's my turn. And you know, we have gotten that good at it, and we understand each other pretty well. And there are times though when there's a crossover there, and I just absolutely refuse. And 9 times out of the 10, I end up saying something that I regret. When I should have paid attention to her wink and just, you know, kept my mouth closed and let her handle it with a little bit of compassion and a different kind of wisdom. But, boy, I'm going to tell you, it took a good 4 or 5 years to learn that. And not to learn it, but to recognize that it was there. And then it probably took another 10 years to fully understand it, you know. And then, so I think we're going on 27 years, something like that. So, yeah, I get it. And I don't know what I'd do without her, because she just, man, she can really, she's really good at the things that she's good at, and I feel like I'm good at the things that I'm good at. And when you learn to work together, it just it makes all the difference, you know, all the difference.
We're in UE KK4JBQ. Well, you know this, but I'll just say it in a different way. You and Anna were challenged to do something that never occurred in my life. You raised a family, and that requires special people to do it right. I've seen special people. I've known special people. And then I was raised in the household I was raised in. you and I have talked about that as well. Raising children is more than imprinting you onto the males of the family or her onto the females of the family. It's again, it's a job that you share. And I had a sister who was a daddy's girl. and she loved her daddy so much. You were so important to your daughter. Four daughters. I know you had three, but I don't know if you had a second son or a second daughter. I don't know. But in any event, it takes two parents. It's so difficult a challenge with two to come out with a well-rounded human being. Not that one in certain circumstances with the challenge might not do just as good a job. It'd be exceptional, though. Really exceptional. KK4JBQ.
4NUE. Well, just to be honest with you, I hate to keep bringing up the deployments, but I mean that came at a cost, and it just seems like we got one deployment over and started to gain ground as a father, and then trying to become a family again, and then then it's ramp up and go out for another one, and I don't know, I missed some pretty critical years there. And I think at the time, in my mind, it was, I justified it in my mind as, okay, well, we need money to survive, and this is what I'm good at, and this is, what I'm going to do. But, make no mistake about it, there was a price to pay for that. A very high price, and I tell my wife all the time that, well, matter of fact, when my firstborn son came out with his fiance last week, and we had the little engagement party, I told Anna when they left that, this is, well, I told them that when you get married, we want grandchildren as quick as possible after you're married. And I think I may have embarrassed her a little bit. I wasn't trying to, but I told Anna when they left that, this is my opportunity for redemption. With a grandchild, I won't be on a deployment or won't be away, and this is, my opportunity to be a papa and try to, in a kind of twisted way, I guess, make things right in my mind, or try to make things different, because I was not always here for my children in some very critical years as far as their development goes. But, it is what it is, and we've moved on and accepted a new normal. And, it's just, it came with a price. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, you're going to know where this comes from. I think it's beholden to those of us who stayed stateside, those of us who lived an otherwise normal life, to be grateful, to offer our gratitude. You've heard it expressed in many different ways. But this is one of the things you sacrificed. It's probably the second, third, fourth, or fifth thing that people think about. But you sacrificed being a father to your children in order that you could serve this country and its people. And I'll just let that go at that. Uh, So, your hopes for grandchildren. That's a hallmark of being human. It really is. I know it is. I have no hopes of having grandchildren because I did not have children. You must first have one to have the other. So just imagine my envy. Try to imagine that for one moment, but then hurry away from it. Because it's not your thing, it's not your place, it's not your opportunity. I've had different opportunities. My sister was one. I was 13 when she came into the world, and I did all the diapering and feeding when she was just a baby. And I'll cherish that. Human life can be made up in so many different ways. There's so many different outcomes. You have a new baby, and it's a blank slate. You've heard that expression. Nothing is set in stone yet. Nothing that they don't know anything but their needs. And you satisfy those needs as best you can early on, and then comes the training and the impression of your life onto their life when you can. And you do that when you can. There'll come a time, and you have to know this already, I'm sure, that you do not have that opportunity anymore. You can't impress them and make life-changing suggestions and be the example that you once were. When they leave the house, when they marry and begin their own family and, you know, all of that. But I thank you in one sense this time around, but I admire you in another. KK4JBQ.
I appreciate that, and I just want you to know that was not the reason for having that discussion at all. To be completely honest with you, it's just a little bit uncomfortable. I just I don't know. It's just what you do. But on the other hand, too, I just be completely honest with you and tell you that I mean, just the straight up truth is that somewhere between the first and second deployment, when I came home from the second deployment, I really just felt like that I was no longer their hero. And, you know, a dad is, especially for a male, is a, you know, the dad is always a hero to a certain age, and then they start to realize that, well, you know, dad makes mistakes, and dad's got some, you know, his idiosyncrasies, and they start to develop as a young man, and start to see that. And that's a little different when the father is there and he can see that transition and start to know that, well, my son's getting of age and that I'm, you know, no longer his childhood hero anymore. Both of you are going through that together. But when you know, you're away from home for a long period of time and you come home and you feel like that there was a switch that happened while I was gone. That's, boy, I'm going to tell you, the deployment was easy. I mean, there were some hard times, don't get me wrong. But that was really difficult. Really difficult. difficult. I mean, just, I cannot tell you. It just, I don't know, it just affects you in so many ways, I guess, as a father. But, I don't know. On the first deployment, my firstborn was at a very young age, and it was his birthday, and I was over there, and I just was really, really struggling, you know, really having a hard time because I missed my son. So I was off for a couple of days, and my lieutenant had a really, really good lieutenant, Lieutenant Dangerfield. And he noticed, you know, hey, you know, something's not right with my platoon sergeant, what's going on. So we sat down, we went to chow hall for breakfast, and I just wasn't talking and had just totally disengaged for a couple of days. And he just said, hey, you know, what's going on with you? Something's not up, and I need you to talk to me. And, you know, maybe we can, you know, maybe I can help you with this. And I told him, it's my son's birthday, and I'm really having a hard time with that. So we talked through that for a little bit, and I didn't think anything about it. Well, the next day was, you know, my son's birthday, and he had contacted, him and the commander had contacted my wife back home and arranged a teleconference. And my wife had arranged for her father to take Lewis, my son, to a little birthday party. And we arranged a conference through the EastPak satellite, 250,000 miles out in outer space. No telling what that telephone call cost the taxpayers, but I was able to, you know, at least have a telephone conference with my son, with his grandfather, and talk with him for about 30 minutes. And I don't know, that made all the difference for me. I don't think my son even remembers it. I doubt he would. But I just, you know, just to put things into perspective, how difficult that was. And I tell you one other thing I noticed for the female soldiers. Boy, you want to talk about difficult now. Boy, that's a whole different hard. I mean, they really struggle with that. And going back to my previous point is that you have to be really precise about how you handle something like that. And you can't be hard. You can't be, you know, that horrible leader who doesn't recognize that. You have to, you know, you have to be cognizant of that. But I know how hard it was for me as a father. I could not imagine as a mother. And we had several females that went through that. You know, you're through a 12-month deployment. Everybody's going to go through that because it's a 12-month year. But, boy, I'm telling you, they really struggled with it. And, you know, you have to struggle with them. And when my lieutenant helped me with that, I never forgot that, hey, instead of hollering and screaming because I wasn't running the platoon and making things happen, he said, hey, what's going on, you know? And he helped me with it. And I don't know, people like that just, they make a big difference in your life. And, boy, that was, I never will forget that.
We are given opportunities. Many times I have let them slip right by me. I only realize it, oh my, the next day, 2 years from the from that moment, it strikes me that, gee, I had an opportunity to change things. I had an opportunity to change the course of my life with just a different mindset, just a different way of looking at that thing. And well, this reflection, it is helpful, even if it's way after the fact. It's helpful to reflect. You can grow a little bit even then, years later. But what we know now, it's still valuable to us. The things that we might regret, things that were said or left unsaid, it's still helpful because you never know when you'll be challenged again with something similar. Not the same thing, but something similar. It is, wisdom is something that accumulates. We aren't born with it, for crying out loud. We're not born with anything much. But it's also something that can't be given to you as a gift. Wisdom is something that requires endurance quite often. There is a cost. And again, I want to say the cost, said differently, the price that you paid was very high. And, well, so one thing that you and I do not do, have not done, is intentionally give other people a chance to come in, if they will. Now, I know it's coming up on 1 o'clock, but there might be somebody who's listened, who's been along for this ride the whole time, and they won't join us unless they're encouraged. So as this is a good time to try to make it right, I'll say, this is KK4JBQ with KO4NUE. If there's somebody out there listening that would like to contribute to this conversation, you're welcome to come in now. Shot in the dark, man. It wasn't. KK4JBQ. I will try to remember to perforate our conversations. They can mean a lot to you and me, but somebody else out there might want to add their 2 cents. I'll try to remember that going forth. KK from the JBQ.
I should have caught that too, Larry, but I just kind of got involved in the conversation, I guess. But at any rate, if anybody's offended, I apologize for that. Should have been a little more professional, I guess. But at any rate, Larry, I have really enjoyed the conversation. I'm gonna hang with you for a few more minutes, and we'll go ahead and bring it to a close, and probably give you a holler on the telephone sometime tomorrow, and touch base with you on the telephone for a little while. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. But I think eventually you and I may need to deal with the inevitable and maybe eventually have a conversation about possibly meeting for lunch or doing a face-to-face. But I'll leave that in your court. I'm retired, and I do some community service with local American Legion chapter in Tryon, North Carolina. We do some, you know, work for the community in various and assorted ways. I've got a really unique way I contribute. I won't get on that topic on the radio, but I contribute nonetheless. And I am partial to trying to help some of the older veterans, and there are some out there that I visit frequently to try to, you know, help where I can. But I'm just kind of that way with anybody, I guess. And but anyway, I do want to ask you a serious question, and it's kind of late, and I'm hoping I take advantage of that, and not too many people listening. But I'm kind of looking for your honest opinion on something.
Fair.
So, how? I don't know how to word this even. The couple of times I have done the net, I'm kind of struggling a little bit with laughter on the net. I'm a happy, kind of a happy person, and sometimes it's hard to get control of my laughter, and I think some people could see that as unprofessional, or maybe just how scattered I do things sometimes. But I know you've been got a lot more experienced as a radio operator or a ham than I have. And there again, I'm going to go back to that frame of reference thing. That, you know, I have a frame of reference. And that is completely opposite most of the time compared to being, you know, a ham operator. But just want to know what your thoughts on that are, because if that's an issue, I need somebody to step up and tell me so I can be, you know, a little bit more professional if that's what I need to do. But just want to know what your observation is about that, and be just straight up.
In my experience as a ham, I have put it in this framework. I am an amateur radio operator. I'm not a professional. What we are involved in right now is not a broadcast, although many people might be able to hear it. It is not a broadcast. There were questions on your tech exam that alluded to these two things. But in any event, a professional and an amateur can be unprofessional. That's the other side of the coin that we might share. We both have the possibility of doing things wrong, of being of breaking the rules of etiquette, good taste, you know, being, I was looking for a word, being snarky. That's unprofessional. We learn that there are some things that are okay, appropriate to talk about on airwaves that we are licensed to use that might be benefit to the general population of other hams or people listening on other devices, communications radios that are only receivers, scanners, you know, we covered all that in just recently. But when we push this button, we're doing something that is a licensed activity, and we should respect it for that. Laughter is something that I think it's for its intended experience anyway. Laughter is something that only human beings can do, and for the purpose that we understand, to be jovial, to communicate a good spirit. So I say it that way to follow up by saying, no one's going to have any problem with your laughter for you being the human that you are, and that goes over the airwaves. Well, I've heard some professional broadcasters on commercial radio bust out in laughter. It was appropriate at the moment, and they just hauled off and did it. I could say names and you'd recognize them. And they're popular primarily, the people that I'm referring to, because they are showing their humanness, not just their professionalism, no. They're showing that they're human. So I hope I've covered that and haven't obscured the answer that I want to impart. It is okay. Even encouraged. There's some people I listen to on the radio that I wish they would bust out in laughter once in a while. And in the rare instance when they have, oh boy, what a treat. What an absolute treat to hear them laugh. KK4JBQ.